Good afternoon. My name is Catherine Tucker and I'm a professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management. And today I'm going to be presenting some research I have into the surprising failure of big data in an online advertising world. Before I start, I have two apologies. The first and most obvious is that I apologize very much for not being at the hearings in person. I have teaching scheduled on every single day of the hearings from morning to afternoon, and I'm very sorry not to be with you. It looks like an amazing program. The second apology is, unlike many of the presentations you're going to see over these 3 days, I'm going to be presenting a research paper today. And the nature of a research paper, of course, especially an empirical one like this, is it tends to go after a very, very narrow set of findings, but make sure that we can really believe in those narrow set of findings. But the second apology is that what you're going to hear is about a very specific set of experiments in a very specific context. So having said that, perhaps we should actually move to the context. And as I alluded to, this paper is a paper about big data in online advertising. And to set the background, I want to just remind you about how important data could be when we're thinking about showing ads to a pair of eyeballs on a particular website. And I also want to tell you about different types of data that a publisher of the website, let's imagine it's a news site, and an advertiser could potentially use to make sure they're showing the right ad to the right person. The first thing they could do is they could use something called first party data. And that's data that the website naturally has access to because it knows the kind of content that the consumer has browsed, for example, in the past. So if that news website knows that if ever I see a cruise story, I read it, then perhaps they could use that data to make sure that they show me an ad for an upcoming cruise. Now, second party data is a little bit more of a narrow category, and this is the category of data where a website has data from a partner and they know exactly who that partner is and what kind of data they're getting. And so a good example of that I came across recently is that Rough Guides, a kind of travel book, shares data, browsing data explicitly with lastminute.com, which is a travel website. And you can imagine why they share data and why it might be useful for working out what ad to show. If someone's just booked a cruise to Italy, then if I'm Rough Guide, I want to show them an ad about my guidebook to Italy. And similarly, if I'm lastminute.com and I found out that someone's been buying guidebooks about Italy, it might be time to get those Italy hotel ads up on my website. The key thing though about this kind of data is that this is data where everyone knows what it is and where it's coming from. The last category of data, and this is the data I'm going to be focusing on in this presentation, is something called third-party data. And this is data purchased from a third-party source with the aim of identifying what we call in marketing a customer segment or a particular kind of customer you might think is interested in your product or service. Now, the actual purchase of this data is extremely complex and subject to a lot of different technologies. I'm going to simplify the terminology slightly in this presentation and just talk about data brokers. And you can think of data brokers as being analogous to a data aggregator that comes and collects all the different data sources from browsing behavior across the web, sometimes offline behavior too, into a file which summarizes all the information that is known about a particular cookie or a particular pair of eyeballs that is browsing the internet. Now, as you can imagine, these data brokers have a lot of data. And as ever with data, just getting pure data in place doesn't actually help that much. You need to make inferences about who the customer is and what they might be interested in if you want to determine what ad to show them. And this paper is going to be all about how good the algorithms are which use this data to try and make inferences about consumers and what kind of ads they might be interested in. So to give you an example of what I mean about this third party data, I thought we would start with a specific example, and I'm going to show you how to do this with Twitter. Now, why Twitter? Well, simply because it's actually quite straightforward to get access to this kind of data on the Twitter platform about yourself. And also, my gut feeling about the audience of the FTC hearings is many, many people have a Twitter account. So what you should be doing right now is getting out your mobile, if you're not already playing around with it, and follow along to see how you can find out what data Twitter has about you, which is this kind of third-party data where people or algorithms have made inferences about your profile as a consumer. So what you do is you get out your Twitter profile, and you go and look at settings and privacy. You can see that I have highlighted it right on the left-hand screen right there. And then after that, you go and choose, you go to the privacy and safety screen, and you scroll down to the bottom where you have the opportunity to see your Twitter data. Then on the next screen, I would like you to select the second option, which is this third party data, which is all about inferred interests that Twitter has from these third parties who've been collating data about your browsing of the internet. Now, if you click on this for me, I'll show you what I see. So you're going to see a whole lot of different things that these third party datas and their algorithms have inferred about you. This is what they've inferred about me. Now, here you can see that they think I have one child. Here, I should apologize to my other three children. I obviously don't browse enough about you. You can also see that my web browsing patterns has led Twitter to infer that I'm definitely a senior in terms of my age range. I think probably the thing I worry the most about is how it is that these third-party brokers have inferred that I'm a single parent. I think at this point I really do have to apologize to my poor husband. Anyway, the key thing here for the purposes of this talk is that you can see demographics, what they've inferred about your demographics, right? Because in general, a pair of eyeballs browsing on a mobile phone or a desktop, there's no real way of sort of telling, you know, exactly what your background demographics are. So these algorithms are going to use the data about your browsing to try and infer what your demographics are from your browsing. And that's going to be the focus of this study. Now, the specific name of the paper I'm going to be talking about, if you want to read it in detail and, you know, go into all the nitty-gritty, is up on SSRN, so you can easily find it there, and it's called How Effective is Black Box Digital Consumer Profiling? and audience delivery evidence from field studies. I should highlight that this is not work I've done by myself. Instead, I have a wonderful team of co-authors. Nicole Noman is at the University of Melbourne Business School, and he is an amazing, very junior professor who really cares about this industry and trying to work out what's going on. And Tip Whitfield was actually at one of the large advertising agencies at the time we wrote the paper, and he organized for us to get access to this world to study how well it works. So, you know, huge gratitude to my co-authors. This paper consists of three separate studies, and in all these studies we are asking, how well does the big data and online advertising ecosystem do in terms of identifying gender and age? Why gender and age? Well, first and most importantly for us, they're things you can actually potentially verify. The second reason we use them is it's actually a very popular form of data that advertisers use for targeting. Indeed, if you look at from industry surveys, at least, these age data, gender data tend to be the most broadly used types of data for the targeting of ads. Now, the way we proceeded, as I say, there are three studies, and in each study, we actually try to make the task of identifying whether a particular pair of eyeballs was of a certain gender, of a certain age, easier and easier. The first study was the most broad brush. As such, I'll go through it quickly. And then what we did there was we went to various ad platforms and said, can you show our ad 100,000 times to men between the ages of 25 and 54? When we gave them this simple mission, there was a large range of success, but we found that they were able to do this on average about 59% of the time when we compare their performance with our benchmark, which was Nielsen data that actually recorded the age and gender of the eyeballs that were seeing our ads. Now, in some sense, let's be clear, this is an improvement relative to sheer chance. Sheer chance would be below a third given the makeup of the internet population. So there is an improvement of 184% when we use the data, big data ecosystem to try and enhance our advertising. I think though the point we try and make in the paper is yes, it's definitely an improvement. But given that advertisers tend to be paying more than 200% more to show their ads using these data targeting tools rather than just showing them by chance to everyone, it wasn't quite clear to us that the return on investment was there. Now, that was our first study, and you might say it was somewhat unfair because it was still relying a lot on humans to have discretionary choices, perhaps, about how they set up the campaign, and that could explain this failure we're seeing. So in our next study, we went to try and take out that human element. What we did for the next study was we tried to make it easier for data brokers to do this, and we sort of tried to take out the human element. And so in our second study, what we did is we said, we have this website. Please, data brokers, tell us who the audience of the website is. So there was no discretion in finding particular eyeballs. You just had to tell us who the eyeballs at the website was. Now, when we did this test with four separate data brokers. On average, what was just striking is that they told us in terms of proportion of men, it was 58%, it was 55%, 85%, 63%. I'm not sure what we can say about accuracy here. It doesn't seem great to me. If I got back those numbers, I would still not quite know what the true proportion of men is. What was also striking to me about the study, and you should see it in the paper, It's that never mind getting the gender right. They had no idea these when we asked people what the actual number of eyeballs was on these websites. At least there was huge, when I say no idea, what I mean is there was huge variation in the answers we were given, which ranged all the way from 300,000 to 500,000 eyeballs, which is a large difference if you're an advertiser. So the second study didn't give us much reassurance that we're really getting accurate information here. So what we decided to do in our third study was to just make the task as simple as you could ever possibly imagine. And in this task, what we said to each data broker was, look, you don't have to tell us about a particular website. All you have to do is tell us, do you have data or profile about this particular cookie? And if you do, can you tell us what gender you think this cookie and the set of eyeballs associated with this cookie are? Now, you might be saying, okay, you keep on saying you know really how many, you know, what gender people are, how do you know the truth? And what we did in this study to find out the truth, which, you know, I find quite compelling, is that we used a service named Pure Profile to actually verify what the truth is. And what Pure Profile goes out to do is they actually survey people. And so they go out and say, what gender are you? What age are you? And they give you awards for answering correctly. And so we use that as our source of truth about what the true gender, true age is. And you may, of course, be cynical and say, well, are people answering an online survey really going to be particularly honest? And of course, I'm sure there are some people who are not honest when answering these surveys. However, it's going to be our source of truth, and at least it's what we think of as declared data, or what people want you to think about their age and gender. And so we're going to use that as our measure of the truth. And the question is what did we find when we compared this declared data to what the data brokers were telling us? And you can see here we actually used a lot of different data brokers in this study. And there was a wide range of how many cookies they told us they had information for. And you can see that in the second column. What I want you to look at, though, is the third column. And we actually asked them the specific task of telling us whether or not that cookie was male. And that's going to be our measure of gender accuracy. And the number you see in the third column is the percentage of times they were able to correctly tell us that a cookie was male. And I want you to look at those numbers and also register the fact, which I always found the most hilarious about this study and this paper in general, is that if you sort of take the average of accuracy, we're really pretty close to 50%. In other words, these data brokers, this entire big data ecosystem, seems to be able to tell us the gender of a pair of eyeballs correctly half of the time. And if you've ever taken probability theory and you thought about the distribution of men and women, you will see why this is quite funny. The other thing I want you to look at in this table is the second column, which is the number of cookies. And the reason I think this is important for this meeting, I don't usually emphasize it when presenting the paper, but I think it's interesting, is that in some sense you might think of this as a measure of how much data the data broker is really working with, right? Because we asked them, well, how many cookies can you tell us about? And so it seems reasonable to infer that if they can tell us about more cookies, they have more data. Now, the reason this is important is that if you were to try and think about a correlation between the second column and the third column and look to see is there any relationship between the amount of data that these data brokers appear to have access to and how good they are at telling me gender correctly. You know, there's not, you know, it's not really enough data points to run a regression, but I look at it and stare at it and could just see no numerical correlation really whatsoever. So I think this is important because it suggests there's a surprising lack of correlation between access to data and how well these data brokers are performing in terms of being able to use an algorithm to infer gender. So let's just summarize the findings of this research. So I think the big headline news, and this is going to spill over, I'm sure, into the meetings in 2 weeks' time, is that in general, we often worry about algorithms, big data, AI, and we tend to worry them more from an Orwellian, privacy-intrusive way. However, I'm here to tell you that you might be worried about these algorithms being too accurate. I'm really worried about the fact that they seem to be surprisingly bad at actually getting something very basic like being able to infer gender from browsing behavior. Now, I say it's very straightforward, but when you think about it, maybe there's a reason these algorithms are doing not that but poorly. I mean, I challenge everyone in this room to think about the internet sites you browse and really how informative are they about gender. I can imagine that there are perhaps some particular websites which tell you a lot about gender, maybe, you know, a website devoted to the merits of sanitary products or something like that. I don't think there are probably many men browsing those types of websites. But in general, if you think about the browsing behavior, it's probably not very gendered. And I think that's the sort of overarching problem these algorithms are facing, that they're trying to infer something which maybe is just not inferable given how different our browsing behavior, given how differently genders really perform, use the internet, people of the same gender use the internet. You know, the other, you know, reason this is going on is actually even more simple. And, you know, this is not a complete explanation, but it's certainly a partial information. And one of the reasons these algorithms appear to be failing is that we look to see how does their accuracy vary with household size. And we show that as your household gets bigger, I mean, as you have more than one person potentially using a computer or a device, then the accuracy does appear to fall. So simple explanation, we're trying to infer gender potentially from a computer, which in my case is used by my husband, used by me, used by my kids to watch My Little Pony videos. It's going to be very hard to actually work out what gender a pair of eyeballs are when you don't have just one pair of eyeballs. Now, another point I want to make is not just that this kind of data inference process and the use of algorithms on big data doesn't seem to provide necessarily insights that we might fear it does in terms of how accurate it is. It's just because these are hearings about competition, is that you often hear repeated the mantra, the idea that there is a link between access to data and the ability to compete. And especially in a world of algorithms, you can see the argument for that, in that perhaps if I have a larger data set, I can train my algorithm to perform that much better and be able to outcompete my rivals. However, what I saw in this study, at least in this early, potentially early and nascent stage of this industry, is that, you know, the size of data didn't seem to matter that much for really, or really at all that I could see in the data, for how well these data brokers were doing in terms of accuracy. And that suggests perhaps an argument, which I think we'll probably be hearing about in 2 weeks, that really the quality of algorithms are going to be potentially more important, and the quality of people who are able to program these algorithms may end up being more important than the actual size of data that are used to train these algorithms. So with that, I will say thank you so much for listening. Apologies again for not being in attendance. It does look wonderful. And if you have any questions, feel free to email me. Thank you very, very much.